Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
A disinformation tsunami.
Bots, fake accounts and real people.
I see disinformation in so many different ways.
We didn't know what to listen to. We didn't know what to follow.
Where is there reliable information?
Whose truth? Available now. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 8th of June, these are our main stories. Israel reacts with fury to a plan to put its army on the UN's official list of organisations that harm children in conflict zones. President Biden has spoken in defence of democracy and against isolationism on the site of a Nazi stronghold stormed by American troops on D-Day. And Russia's President Vladimir Putin says he doesn't rule out changing Russia's nuclear doctrine if he felt the country is threatened.
This doctrine is a living instrument, and we watch closely what is happening in the world and around us. We don't exclude making some changes.
Also in this podcast,
even having gone through a lot of stuff in my life so far, having to sit for the college entrance examination, also known as Gaokao, remains one of the most stressful or even borderline traumatizing experiences in my life.
Over 13 million students in China are gearing up for the big end of high school exams. Israel appears to have joined a list which in the past has included Afghanistan, Syria and extremist groups such as Islamic State and Boko Haram. Israel says the UN has included the Israeli army on an annual blacklist of countries and organisations which harm children in conflict zones. The list is due to be released next week. Diplomatic sources say that Islamic Jihad and Hamas were also going to be on the UN blacklist. The Israeli government has reacted with fury. Here's Gilad Erdan, Israel's envoy to the United Nations.
I am utterly shocked and disgusted by this shameful decision of the Secretary General. Israel's army is the most moral army in the world. So this immoral decision will only aid the terrorists and reward Hamas.
Hugo Beshega, our correspondent in Jerusalem, has more details.
Thousands of children have been killed in Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza, and thousands more are in desperate need of humanitarian help. Now, this annual list by the UN Secretary General covers the killing of children in conflict and also the denial of access to aid and the targeting of schools and hospitals. It's still not clear what accusations the Israeli military is facing, but this decision, if it's taken, will put more pressure on the country's authorities. And unsurprisingly, there's been strong reaction from Israeli officials. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the UN had added itself to the blacklist of history. And again, he said the Israeli military was the most moral army in the world. Now, the Israeli foreign minister said this decision would have an impact on the country's relations with the United Nations. Now, there have been reports suggesting that both Hamas and Islamic Jihad will also be added to the list. And there has been reaction from the Palestinians as well. A spokesman for the Palestinian president told the Reuters news agency that this decision was a step closer to holding Israel accountable for its crimes. Now, in another development, Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, is returning to the Middle East. He will be in the region next week. He will be visiting Egypt, Israel, Jordan and Qatar to put pressure on both Israel and Hamas to reach a ceasefire deal in Gaza. There have been talks in recent days, but there has been no breakthrough in these negotiations. Now, President Biden last week announced this proposal. He described it as an Israeli proposal that would see the release of hostages being held in Gaza and pave the way for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, a key Hamas demand, but a divisive issue in Israel.
Hugo Beshega in Jerusalem. Against the backdrop of a pure blue sea and sky, President Biden has made an emotional plea to the American people to follow the example of the soldiers who fought in the Second World War and look out to the world rather than isolate themselves from the international disorder of the 21st century. He was speaking at Pont du Hoc, where US Army Rangers scaled a 35-metre cliff in Normandy on D-Day to seize Nazi artillery. Mr. Biden, standing in front of the memorial which commemorates the decisive battle, said that America remains pivotal to world order, as it did in 1944.
I simply refuse to believe that America's greatness is a thing of the past. I still believe there's nothing beyond our capacity in America when we act together. We're the fortunate heirs of a legacy of these heroes. Those who scale the cliffs, Pont du Hoc, we must also be the keepers of their mission, the keepers of their mission, the bearers of the flame of freedom that they kept burning bright. That is the truest testimonial to their lives. Our actions every day to ensure that our democracy endures and the soul of our nation endures.
President Biden said the American soldiers who fought in Europe would recognize the war being fought in Ukraine.
They stood against Hitler's aggression. Does anyone doubt that they would want America to stand up against Putin's aggression here in Europe today? They stormed the beaches alongside our allies. Does anyone believe these Rangers would want America to go it alone today?
Though he never mentioned his name, Mr. Biden seemed to have Donald Trump in his sights. On a June day 40 years ago, another U.S. president, Ronald Reagan, spoke at Pont du Hoc, using the battle to win support back home for his foreign policy agenda. So how did Mr. Biden do? Hugh Schofield is our correspondent in Paris.
In the first half of the speech, it was exactly the same as Reagan's. He was talking about the men and naming some of the men, the Rangers who scaled the cliffs, came up and saying they did it for a great cause. That cause is still alive. The fight against totalitarianism, again, it's Russia. And he's saying, again, like Reagan did, you know, that this should inspire the new generations. Who would believe, he said it over and over again, who would believe that the Rangers who fought here would not do everything in their power to turn back the tide of hateful ideologies and so on. So exactly the same way as Reagan, he's drawing on that imagery, that heroic memory, which is, you know, very, very strongly inculcated in American minds. You know, the Pont du Hoc is the key moment of D-Day for them, and trying to draw a sort of moral message for today.
So open criticism of Vladimir Putin, but how much also of this was criticism of Donald Trump?
I've no doubt at all that it was all intended for a domestic audience. The way it was stage managed with music, with the wonderful backdrop of the channel, handshakes with the veterans, and then the content that, you know, implicitly, I think it all was attack on Donald Trump, though he didn't once mention Donald Trump's name. I think that would have been seen as out of place, going too far. This was a foreign policy speech, but the underlying message was clearly that you know, the Biden stood with the Rangers for an international alliance of free nations against totalitarianism, and that by implication, President Trump didn't. And it all was an implicit criticism, an attack on Donald Trump.
Hugh Schofield. Russia's President Vladimir Putin wasn't invited to the commemorations in Normandy. Instead, he gave a lengthy address at an economic forum in St. Petersburg, in which he said he doesn't rule out changing Russia's nuclear doctrine if he feels the country is threatened. Currently, the use of nuclear weapons is theoretically allowed by the Kremlin if Russia's sovereignty or territorial integrity is under attack. He also reserved the right to supply Russian weapons to countries hostile to the West. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg was listening.
Since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Moscow has been engaged in nuclear saber-rattling, dropping less than subtle hints to the West it shouldn't push Russia too far. Today, President Putin said that Russia wouldn't need to use nuclear weapons to achieve victory in Ukraine. For a moment, he looked quite the dove compared to the man asking him the questions at an economic forum panel discussion. Foreign policy expert Sergei Karaganov had called for a preemptive nuclear strike on Europe. But then came a warning. Mr. Putin said that Russia's tactical nuclear weapons were three or four times as powerful as the ones America had dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that Russia has many more of them than Europe does. He described Europe as more or less defenseless. And for the second time in a week, he said that Russia was considering supplying other countries with conventional long-range Russian missiles that could be used to strike Western targets, his response to NATO allies allowing Ukraine to use similar-class Western weapons to strike Russian territory.
Steve Rosenberg. It's a market that could soon be worth more than $100 billion. Diabetes and obesity drugs like Ozempic and Mounjaro have become famous for helping users lose large amounts of weight. Two companies dominate the industry, Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly, creating something of a space race. But with competitors desperate for a piece of the action, how long can these two giants stay in front? Leanna Byrne reports.
In 2017, a new diabetes medicine hit pharmacies in the U.S.
Looking to get back in your type 2 diabetes zone? Once-weekly Ozempic can help.
It wasn't just getting control of their blood sugar, though. With this one, called Ozempic, users were losing some serious weight. The company that makes it, Novo Nordisk, is now Europe's most valuable company. It can't keep up with demand and, of course, its rivals are queuing up for a piece of the action.
I have struggled with my weight for many years, actually since I was a child.
Michelle Herwum lives in Denmark with her partner and three children. She started back on the weight loss drug Wegovy after coming off it while pregnant. It's expensive, costing Michelle around $200 every month.
A new study has found that one in eight of the world's population are now classed as obese.
That's more than a billion people are classed as obese worldwide. It's a huge market, and at the moment, drug companies are only tapping into a tiny percentage of it.
I think we inspire Novo, and Novo inspires us.
That's Patrick Johnson, Eli Lilly's president of diabetes and obesity, talking to me down the line from the company's HQ in Indianapolis.
Competition just makes us better and better every day.
Some things that made a lot of headlines as well as the shortage of the supply of some of these drugs. Are you finding the same issues that you're not able to keep up with the demand?
We're moving as quickly as we can, but there are at times supply constraints in the market.
We think of it as a somewhat stable duopoly between Novo and Lilly.
That's Emily Field, head of European Pharmaceuticals Equity Research at Barclays.
These two companies are the winners, and everyone else is really scrambling, for lack of a better word, to catch up.
Emily says she's seen a recent flurry of buyouts in the pharmaceutical space because behind Novo and Lilly is a long line of drug makers keen to get a piece of the action.
It's Manun Chakravarthy. I serve as the therapeutic global head for cardiovascular, renal and metabolism product development at Roche.
Dr. Chakravarthy used to work for the California-based biotechnology company Carmot Therapeutics until it was bought out in December by industry giant Roche. Roche needed Carmot's research to give it a foothold into this lucrative diet and diabetes space, and Carmot needed money and resources to develop a new drug.
We're doing everything that we can to accelerate as fast as possible, getting ready for larger studies.
With increased competition, will that mean that the price of these weight loss drugs will come down? Because they are quite high at the moment.
Yeah. So our belief is that just having just a handful of companies trying to supply the world's population to meet the global demand is likely not sustainable. But having more could be a, you know, sort of a healthy way to bring affordability and more importantly, better access.
And another factor that could dictate price is once Novo Nordisk's patents expire, its monopoly is over. And that could happen as soon as 2026 in some markets outside of Europe and the US. At that point, other drug makers will jump in and start producing their own copies known as generics, and they'll presumably be a lot cheaper.
Leanna Byrne. West Africa is blessed with natural resources, but countries in the region for decades have tended to focus predominantly on one particular resource. In Nigeria's case, it's oil. But there are now signs of efforts to diversify. For example, the world's two biggest cocoa producers, Ivory Coast and Ghana, have reported a significant increase in gold output. Before independence from Britain in 1957, Ghana was known as the Gold Coast. So why is it now turning back to gold? Our Africa regional editor, Nick Erickson, has the answer.
The rise in gold outputs for two of West Africa's biggest economies points to a bigger story, the crisis in regional cocoa production. West Africa in general, and Ghana and Ivory Coast in particular, have long been synonymous with the crop that finds its way into chocolate bars and coffee cups around the world. But a perfect storm of climate change, disease and mismanagement has meant that there is a crisis brewing. The crop is being decimated rapidly. Ivory Coast has recognized this and is trying to diversify its output into gold, with modest success. Ghana's slight rise in gold output also seems to be in the right direction, but it's thought to be a small-scale mining, unregulated and often dangerous, that is masking declines in the more formalized mining sector in Ghana. This could be a new problem masquerading as a solution to an old one.
Nick Erickson. Still to come, will YouTube's new restrictions on gun videos reduce youth violence?
Social media is, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but what gets put on it, it's done too much damage, it can't stop it.
And why are scientists concerned about the pandemic sweeping through sea urchin populations?
They are like the lawnmowers of coral reefs. And by doing so, they allow corals to thrive and photosynthesize with sunlight.
What stories would you like to share with your daughter? What does she need to know to help her navigate her life ahead? Dear Daughter is the award-winning podcast from the BBC World Service, full of thoughtful letters of advice, personal stories, and life lessons for daughters everywhere. You can catch up with the whole series now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.
One world leader has apologised for his behaviour at Thursday's D-Day commemorations. The British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, left Normandy early to record a campaign interview for the upcoming UK general election. Mr Sunak has said, on reflection, it had been a mistake. Opposition parties have called it a shameful dereliction of duty. And his absence featured in a televised election debate involving leading figures from the UK's seven main parties. Penny Mordaunt, a senior figure in Mr Sunak's Conservatives, sounded more like a member of the opposition.
What happened was completely wrong, and the Prime Minister has rightly apologised for that. Apologised to veterans, but also to all of us, because he was representing all of us.
Our political correspondent Rob Watson watched the debate and began by telling me that the issue of Prime Minister Sunak's blunder over the D-Day commemorations was a big talking point.
It was a huge talking point, and it was always going to be that way, because it's just hard to imagine a more inexplicable gaffe, own goal, whatever you would like to call it, than that committed by the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak in leaving Normandy and leaving those commemorations ahead of other world leaders. And it is absolutely no surprise that opposition politicians have leapt upon it. But I think there's just no secret that it's also really damaged morale within his own governing Conservative Party.
So away from that, your assessment of the debate, the taxation and immigration was again hotly debated.
It was. I mean, the debate, in a funny sort of way, you might have thought with seven politicians, it would be more sort of chaotic, bitter than the one between Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak last week. But it wasn't. I mean, it was a, you know, remarkably civilised affair. I mean, in many ways, it was rather predictable. So if I just sum it up, you have the, you know, they have Penny Mordaunt, who we've already mentioned, essentially saying, look, we've been in power for 14 years. No, it's been tough, but it's only the Conservatives who in their DNA are in favour of a smaller state and lower taxes, where you had the main opposition Labour Party sort of saying, look, come on, after 14 years of the sort of chaos we've had, it's time for change. And the smaller parties essentially trying to argue, look, the two main parties are incredibly similar, so you wouldn't see much difference. I mean, the two sort of moments that stood out for me was when the studio audience cheered at a couple of things. They cheered at someone, one of the nationalist politicians, saying Brexit had been a disaster, and also cheered when one of the nationalists, the same politician, argued that actually migrants had done an awful lot for this country.
Briefly, what impact might this debate have on the election?
Briefly, very little. I say that, Alex, just because everything else so far in the campaign, and in fact for the last few weeks and months, seems to have done little to change the polls, which has Labour comfortably out in front.
Rob Watson. And this is a big year for elections around the world, as we've just been hearing. Here in the UK, voters will be going to the polls in a matter of weeks. So do you have any questions you've always wondered about? We'd love to answer them for you. Nothing is too simple or too strange, as ever. Email us at globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And you can also find us on X at Global News Pod. Following a spate of school shootings in recent years, gun safety advocates in the US have called on social media companies to do more to limit content that promotes gun-related violence. This week, the video sharing platform YouTube announced new restrictions, including a ban on any videos that demonstrate how to remove firearm safety devices. The newsroom's Ella Bicknell reports.
And today I'm going to show you guys how to build a Glock from scratch, and we're going to do it as quick as possible.
Videos like this one teaching people how to make their own gun are easily found on YouTube.
All right, we got a shot.
At the moment, there are no restrictions on who can watch, but that's going to change. On Wednesday, the video sharing platform owned by Google announced videos showing homemade weapons, automatic rifles, and videos promoting firearm accessories like silencers will be restricted to users 18 and older. YouTube is also banning any videos that demonstrate how to remove firearm safety devices. Firearms are said to be the number one cause of death for children in America.
I am sick and tired of it. We have to act. And don't tell me we can't have an impact on this carnage.
That's President Biden speaking after a school shooting in Uvalde, Texas in May 2022, which killed 19 children and two teachers. He called for tougher regulation on gun ownership.
The idea that an 18-year-old kid can walk into a gun store and buy two assault weapons is just wrong.
YouTube says these new rules are designed to reflect the growing issue of gun violence and new issues within the debate, like 3D printed guns, which have become more available in recent years. However, not everyone thinks it will work.
Social media, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but what gets put on it, it's done too much damage, you can't stop it.
Matthew Norford is a youth worker in Manchester in the north of England. His service, called One Message, mentors young people at risk of gun and knife-related violence.
They'll have no effect because they're infatuated by it because it's made to look cool. Someone's going to give you your tablet to watch it because you've already been watching it for the last 2, 3, 4 years. And now you've just blocked my iPad. Well, I'll go to my friends. I'll go to someone who I know. There's always going to be access to it. It's not like they're taking it from YouTube.
YouTube remains optimistic. In a statement, it said it would continue to consult outside experts and review its guidelines to make sure the line is drawn in the right place.
Ella Bicknell. A sea urchin's sharp needle spines might be a painful annoyance for sea swimmers, but as a species, they play a crucial role in keeping coral reefs alive, gnawing away at algae which inhibit coral's growth. However, Israeli scientists say urchin populations in the Red Sea have been hit by a pandemic, which is now spreading to parts of the Indian Ocean. Omri Bronstein from the University of Tel Aviv co-authored this study. He says it could become a global problem.
What is killing the sea urchins is a unicellular protozoan, and the one that we've just identified in the Red Sea is actually identical to the one that was earlier identified in the Caribbean. And the fact that it is the same pathogen across such a huge geographic distance is a reason for concern. Yes, this is still research in progress, but we already know that the sea urchins are not recovering as a population. We don't have Pfizer or Moderna to find cure for sick sea urchins. But what we can do is take actions and be aware of what we're doing to this already suffering environment. For example, pumping out nutrients, that's fertilizers, which actually will boost algal growth, would be the absolutely worst thing you could do at a time like this.
Omri Bronstein from the University of Tel Aviv. Australia's first Aboriginal-owned renewable energy grid has been launched in the remote Northern Territory community of Marlinja. The new microgrid is connected to the national framework but can work independently, powered by a 100-kilowatt solar array and battery. Campaigners say it's a model that could be used in other First Nations communities. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Janie Dixon is an Aboriginal elder in Marlinja. It's a small community that sits between Darwin and Alice Springs in Australia's rugged Northern Territory. Its residents have endured high electricity prices and blackouts that have often lasted for weeks. The solar-powered microgrid will give them energy self-determination.
Now that we've got this solar, we don't need money. Me and my brothers and my children are really proud of what we've got in our community, and we are so happy inside of our stomach and inside of our heart.
The Marlinja microgrid is the first project, not just in the Northern Territory or Australia, but in the Southern Hemisphere, that is 100% Indigenous owned.
Lauren Meller is from Original Power. Over the past 5 years, the Indigenous Energy Charity has worked with residents to build what should be a reliable and resilient source of electricity in a region that has scorching summers and cold winters. Ms. Meller believes the project that cost $500,000 will be an inspiring blueprint for other Aboriginal communities.
Marlinja is the first community-owned microgrid in the Northern Territory, but it's certainly not going to be the last. And it's not just lower cost power, it's also the benefits of training and employment, ownership of that income stream from the generation of electricity that Marlinja residents are already saying will underpin the future of this community.
Campaigners insist that many First Nations people are being left behind in Australia's transition to renewable energy. Putting power into the hands of Indigenous communities could be a vital step forward.
Phil Mercer. A record number of students in China are taking this year's National College Entrance Examination, a two-day ordeal that is billed as the world's largest academic test. Catherine Biaruhanga heard more from our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton.
13.4 million students are registered to take part in the exam. That's up 500,000 from last year. Last year was another record, so it keeps growing every year. And that's because parents' aspirations for their children are growing in China. Many more parents from poor families want their children to be able to go on to higher education and to be able to attend college and university.
And Celia, we mentioned that it's been described as an ordeal. Just talk us through, what do these exams actually consist of and how important are they?
Well, they're called destiny changers in China. So students essentially study for 12 years in order to take this exam, which in many parts of China takes 2 days. It's 2 8-hour days where students will write on everything from Chinese to English, chemistry, physics. Some of the exams even stretch into 3 days. Now, most students are discouraged from ever taking the exam more than once. So it means that your score on this exam is really going to affect your life, or that's how it's built. It's really built up as a huge thing. Parents will accompany their children to the exams, often wearing red. The parents wear red because red is a lucky color. Cities really shut down when these exams are taking place. Construction sites are meant to pause. Traffic and cars are encouraged. Drivers are encouraged to stop honking their horns so that the city will become a bit quieter and not disturb students. So this is really seen as a big deal, a passage from childhood into adulthood once you write the exam.
Sean Huan works for our China unit and he sat the exam more than a decade ago. What was his experience?
Even having gone through a lot of stuff in my life so far, having to sit for that exam remains one of the most stressful or even borderline traumatizing experiences in my life. The pressure began to build up quite literally the moment you enter high school. Everything basically revolved around scoring the highest you can in that life-deciding exam. And the pressure would reach an almost unbearable level during your senior year. I remember we'd go to school at 7 in the morning and just keep studying until 9 p.m., go back to the dorm, sleep, wake up, and go to school at 7 again. And the cycle repeats itself until you face the day that many Chinese call the Judgment Day. It almost sounds religious, but that just comes and shows the pressure surrounding it. I still remember the sheer joy of freedom I felt after finishing the last test. It even felt like we were released from prison in a way. Years later, we'll still joke about having to go through that period of life together because despite all the stress and anxiety we felt, it was also a time of unparalleled camaraderie because it felt like you went through a battle together.
Sean Yuan. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Wayne Moses, and the producer was Carl Josephs. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
What stories would you like to share with your daughter? What does she need to know to help her navigate her life ahead? Dear Daughter is the award-winning podcast from the BBC World Service, full of thoughtful letters of advice, personal stories, and life lessons for daughters everywhere. You can catch up with the whole series now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.